Hello, and welcome to Outrig, the podcast of the ancient future. February 1st, 2171. I'm your host, James Wesley, and this is where we gather and spin the yarns, the stories, for weaving into that true life tapestry of human seafaring. There are many sagas revealed in this tapestry, and we're starting with our saga number one, Remembering the Multihulls. Welcome aboard. I will try to make you comfortable here with our use of the latest CMR technology, which I'm sure you've heard is so stunning, that to fully grasp this potential for us now to reach across time, one really must willingly suspend his disbelief. Yes, indeed, CMR, carbon memory retrieval, I'm just beginning to understand it. It seems that the carbon molecule is carried by all things living or that have once lived. That means you and me and down through all the plants and animals all the way to petroleum and coal. It's all made out of stuff that once lived or is now living. They call it organic. And of course, these carbon molecules, over time, they iterate themselves in a wide variety of substances, and I'll be darned, it's almost like, back when they managed finally to plot the human genome, these molecules tend to remember where they were, how they were wrapped up in various forms over time. By themselves, they don't have that kind of consciousness, but the anthropologists at the University of California, Santa Cruz, have been putting their heads together with the subatomic particle physicists at the radiation laboratory at University of California, Berkeley. And they've come up with a new kind of search engine that can apparently interrogate all the carbon molecules on Earth. They call it Dogpile. And I remember hearing that that was the name of an early search engine that was developed for use with Microsoft. But now that Linux has finally conquered Microsoft, hey, it only took them 150 years. They're using the new Dogpile to search the global ether for carbon atoms that have at one time or another been combined in the same living creature. Until the Dynamog computer begins to find enough atoms that all belong to the same creature to sort of define what that thing was. And now and then, Dynamog comes up with human beings. And I guess it's hard to tell at first, but they've finally found a being whose name was Teoti. At least they think his whole name was Teoti Mantu. And it just happened that there was a linguist who recognized this name as belonging to a language group from ancient Austronesia. And it seems that this guy Teoti was a little kid at about the time that people from ancient Austronesia were preparing to cross to Australia. Now, this goes back, 55 or 60,000 years from the present. That's how powerful this tool is. Gee, talk about carbon memory retrieval. They're talking about retrieving the memories in the mind of Teoti Mantu. From a time back when the first Homo sapiens successfully crossed open sea. Now, anthropologists have long wondered how those early Asian islanders managed to cross the Torres Straits between, say, Java and Australia. The geologists are telling them that the Torres Straits were indeed there 60,000 years ago. It's a blink of an eye in geological time. And, of course, there's nothing left, no evidence of what sort of boats were used. And so it's long been assumed that they used rafts. A raft is, of course, the most basic and in most cases the crudest manner of seafaring implement. And yeah, a flat bundle of logs is perhaps the least hydrodynamic configuration you could possibly put in the water. But they would carry some weight if they were big enough. But within Teoti's memory, there is apparently some evidence that he actually witnessed people loading up and shoving off in rafts that were intended to carry people somewhere else that they weren't coming back from. He wanted to go with them, but he was too young. But apparently a couple of his aunts and uncles went away and never returned. Nevertheless, they seemed to know where they were going. They knew that there was some place to go out there. And how they knew, I guess there's no telling. It might have been that the usual trade winds were reversed and it blew stuff back from Australia onto the Java shore that the local people could not identify. It happened to be a piece of a tree or something that was unique to Australia. I suppose this happened over and over, but otherwise these people had no means of knowing what was out there. Had all of their friends and families simply sailed off the edge of the world, nobody knew. Why? Because nobody came back to tell them. And this really bothered Teoti. He kept hounding his elders for a chance to go, and it turned out that he was old enough now to really work, and so he was very helpful in building the raft, took a great interest, earned himself a place to go, and the real reason he wanted to go was that he wanted to be the one that came back. So he had some very distinct memories of the voyage itself. He proved to be valuable in holding the raft together. When they got to the other side, he found some of his old known people. They had become coastal fisherfolk in their new land, and they had developed a different kind of raft. It was made out of a big log with two little logs alongside, but spaced rather wide apart, so as to keep the main log from turning over and to provide space between the logs for the water to pass through. So the whole thing was so much easier to move, especially by sail and, of course, by paddle. So now Teoti really gets into the program, man. He builds several of these, I think they called them Wanka. Yeah, W-A-N-G-K-A, Wanka, with the accent on the big A. It's not certain that that word goes that far back, but it's the earliest Austronesian word for just plain boat. And now Teoti really got wound up. These smaller rafts, or wankas, did not have to carry a lot of weight. They were coastal fishing vessels. And Teoti could build one. He actually built several and had to experiment a lot with the means of lashing them together. And now when his elders realized that what he really wanted to do was go back and tell the other people that they'd found this wonderful land on the other side of the straits, they all got behind him and helped him out and helped him mount a small expedition in a small boat, a boat that would really sail, not nearly as clunky as a raft, but still, I guess, probably pretty clunky. They were solid logs, although of a very lightweight species. And again, Teoti recalls specifically of having a hell of a time holding his wanka together on the way back across to the Asian mainland. And when he got back with the news, of course, that his people had been able to establish themselves in a new land, he also brought with him the word that life as a colonial on the north coast of Australia was really hard. They were making it, but it was a whole new environment to which they had to evolve, which they did to some extent over this subsequent period of 50 or 60,000 years under extremely isolated conditions. Apparently no one else arrived. And today's Australian Aborigines people have very little recollection of in their song lines and so on. There's hardly a mention of where they came from. They just consider themselves to have always been there in Australia. And furthermore, it's not really known whether Teoti's three-log raft made any difference back on the Asian side of the straits. Now, it is thought that the multi-hull type of vessel did eventually emerge from island Asia, but it may have been much later. This whole incident with Teoti Mantu and the Australian Aborigines is, we've got to find a lot more evidence. We've got to get Unimog really cranking out there in the ether to gather all those carbon atoms together to tell us more about the story of the true origins of the multi-hull vessel. But I think if anyone is building a boat or contemplating buying one and wants to come up with a name for it, how about Teoti Mantu? We really don't know how it would be spelled in English, but I suppose it's T-E-O-T-I-M-A-N-T-U. I think it'd be a great boat name. You could also name it Wonka or other more modern terms from the Philippines, for instance. They don't call them Wonka, they call them Banka. Their canoes are all variations on the Banka. And in Polynesia, it's Vaka, V-A-K-A. Those would all indicate boat names that really reach back into the origins of the multi-hull type. Now, this new CMR technology may begin to reveal some of this, but it looks now like that whole thing with Teotihuacan was a flash in the pan. It didn't go anywhere in terms of long history. Indeed, multi-hull development may have been arrested there for something like 50,000 years. And if we go back, you know, just a couple of hundred years, in that period between what they call the World Wars, World War I and World War II, in between there someplace, there was the great dean of American yacht design, Nathaniel Harrisoff. And he experimented with two log rafts, or what we now call catamarans. He was able to build several. They went like stink, very lightly built by the Carvel plank method. And several others started building them too. They were day sailing yachts. And the phenomenon was developing a bit of momentum at about the time that the New York Yacht Club decided that those catamarans were not going to be able to race with their otherwise monohull vessels. But that catamaran phenomenon, the Harrisoff phenomenon, did not take hold. It didn't last. They didn't quite develop enough inertia to have activities among themselves. So that, too, died out for a period of about 50 years. That was back in the 1880s. Multi-hulls didn't start to happen again until the mid-1940s. And by the 1960s, the trimaran, modern trimaran, had been evolved. Really a classic case of reinvention reaching back as far as Teotihuacan. But multi-hulls had some other setbacks, too. In the 1960s, one of their great proponents, Mr. Arthur Piver, disappeared at sea without a trace. And it's been said that that set the multi-hull phenomenon back about 10 years, which is better than 50 years or better than 50,000. And by the 1970s, you know, just 200 years ago, the so-called modern multi-hull had pretty well established itself as a viable branch of marine architecture. And as we know, that branch has become quite crucial to our survival today. For example, I'm told that this team that is working on the carbon memory project, there's the team of atomic particle people from Berkeley, and the anthropologists from down in Santa Cruz. And when they get together nowadays, they can do most of their work apart, but when they do have to get together to perform experiments and really think this thing out, they have to come and go by the high ship, the hybrid ship. You know, so much of our coastal infrastructure has been flooded that the only way to get along the coast is to do it offshore. I think they have four of these vessels that are serving the coastal route, the so-called hybrid ships that are hydrofoil-borne and propelled by these so-called hybrid wings. They can just get them under the Golden Gate Bridge now. If the sea keeps rising, they're going to have to do something else in order to allow those vessels to run into San Francisco Bay. Boy, it'd be a shame to have to remove the Golden Gate Bridge, but there's so little traffic on it nowadays compared to what it was built for, and the maintenance costs are now extreme. I think there's a movement afoot to take it down, get it out of the way. But the high ship ferry service inside the Golden Gate, the whole San Francisco Bay area, it has enlarged enormously. You know, by the turn of the millennium, so much of the old San Francisco Bay had been filled in order to provide more land for the cities. Something like 40% of the original San Francisco Bay had been filled in. And of course, that's all navigable now, except by the hydrofoil vessels who stay out of water that shallow. But the simple so-called displacement multi-hulls can take you all the way to Fresno nowadays. But a lot of those towns are drying up because the famous California Central Valley, which was really the truck garden for the nation, has been completely inundated. And so the flood has actually caused a lot of those foothill towns to dry up economically. We could have seen it coming if we'd listened to the experts. You know, the geologists have been trying to tell us that the California's Central Valley was once all part of San Francisco Bay anyway. So, of course, the flood has opened up a whole lot of routes through protected water for the modern non-hydrofoil multi-hulls. But the big high ships, the ones that are running up and down the both coasts now, they're as big as a jetliner and as roomy and comfortable as an old streamliner train. But their operations are hampered by one great disadvantage to that type of vehicle, which is taking off. It's been a big problem for marine designers for, 200 years, that the problem with sailing hydrofoil vessels is that they spend too much time not flying. So keeping schedule has been a real problem for the coastal vessels in certain times of the year when there's not enough wind to get them going fast enough to come up out of the water onto their hydrofoils, the so-called takeoff window. But there's some recent news, I don't know whether you've heard about it yet, but Boeing, good old Boeing, you know, they encountered a lot of problems during the period of aircraft development, but this one about high ship development really did cause them quite a challenge, and I think maybe they've got the answer. They get the passengers involved. Of course, these boats all have small electric auxiliary engines, mostly just for keeping going in flat calms and also for maneuvering in the harbors. But in the interest of lightweight, they've kept the size of these auxiliary installations way down, and the weight of their batteries is a serious consideration. So if there's not enough wind in the hybrid wings and not enough electricity in the batteries to generate that enormous burst of power that it takes to get a big ship like that to jump up out of the water and fly on its hydrofoils, if they could just get over that hurdle, well, the way they're doing it now, at least one operating prototype out of Seattle, is that each passenger seat has a pedaling unit underneath the seat. You pull it out from under your seat, put it out in front of you, and you can get your feet on the pedals. And each pedal drives a small dynamo, which feeds the electric power system for the boat. And so the captain can get on the horn and address the people with their public address system and say, okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to ask you for some help in order to get us to break out through the takeoff window. When I holler, pedal, I hope everybody will pitch in. Okay, here we go. Wind her up, Joe. Pedal now, boing. Oh, man, they got 200 people sitting around in there. They may as well take the power of those legs and put it into the electrical system to, fly right out of the takeoff window. Now, they don't think they're going to have to use that method very often because they've also got it figured out that they can use that auxiliary electric power system to actually charge the batteries. If there's plenty of wind, they can afford to drag the propellers and thereby charge the batteries. It's just like running downhill in one of the old hybrid cars. Now, these current developments are in great contrast with the new information coming to us through, carbon memory retrieval about such action as Teotihuacan and his three-log raft. We don't need carbon recovery for the modern multi-hull origins going back just a couple hundred years. And one reason we don't is we owe a whole lot to that thing I've told you about, the outrig collection. Most of that information was put together by our, original founder of the project, Mr. Jim Brown and his associates. Apparently they were all really whacked out boat nuts. And they put all this stuff together for the Mariner's Museum in Newport News, Virginia, It used to stand on relatively high ground, so it was never flooded out, but that perfect hurricane they had in 2019, they call that one Zeta. They had so many hurricanes that season, tropical depressions anyway, they ran through the whole alphabet, ended up with Zeta. Well, fortunately, much of the outrigg collection survived that storm. A good part of the museum was badly damaged, but they had built a new library, and in the funding, they predicted that it was going to have to be a real bunker in order to survive the weather we were having. So we have the outrigg collection to tell us about how the multi-hull phenomenon progressed from about 1945 or 47 on up until about 2020. They have both the digital record and much of the original material survives to this day. That whole outrigg effort was a private initiative, you know, just a few guys got together and pushed on it and made it happen. They had a small website for years, finally were convinced to put the thing up on Facebook, and the membership started taking off, and they had enough support so that that this guy Brown and his videographer partner, who's also named Brown, he was called Scott Brown, so Jim Brown and Scott Brown finally were able to get the dough together for traveling to France and for going to Australia and New Zealand, where a lot of the early 21st century multi-hull pioneering was done. So they collected a lot of additional data and left us with a fairly comprehensive view of the emergence of the modern multi-hull in the last half of the 20th century and first part of the 21st century. So we don't need CMR to recover that information. The digital record survives, and much of the original material is still there at the Mariner's Museum Library, if you can figure out a way to get there. It's best to take the high ship. So anyway, what we're still about here at the Outrigg is trying to utilize the evolution of the modern multi-hull vessel to serve as an example. Just one example, albeit a good example, of how modern technology can be applied to ancient concepts to achieve futuristic results. Just look what's happened since Teotihuacan. Yeah, now they cross the Torres Straits with a high ship. Anyway, patient listener, thank you for your willingness to suspend your normal natural disbelief. This CMR stuff is just, you know, outlandish. Who would have believed they'd find memory in the atom? So until we resume our Ancient Future series with Remembering the Multi-Hull, it was Danny put me up to it. This is your host, James Wesley, wishing you and your crew fair winds. Bye-bye. Hey, we gotta find some spacey theme music for this stuff, huh?